Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes some members of the community more vulnerable to poverty than others? And what do we lose as a society when we forget that even those who struggle financially can bring great strength and skill to their communities? My guest today has spent decades fighting social and economic injustice, first as a church pastor and later as president and CEO of the faith-based human and community development corporation City Square, formerly called Central Dallas Ministries. Now Larry James has written a book that shares what he's learned over the years about not just the great needs of people in crisis, but also about their ability and desire to contribute to the community in substantive ways. The new book is called The Wealth of the Poor: How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to start right off the top by talking about this term, the poor, which you use here because everybody sort of knows what it means, but you find deeply problematic.
It's very problematic. And as I wrote this book, I almost always put it in quotes because, in fact, everyone's rich and everyone's poor, just in different ways. And when we don't value the wealth of all, we lose that human capital to the application of solving our problems, to finding new inventive ways of doing things better. And just we lose respect for one another in the overall community if we don't see the wealth that's everywhere.
You know, I remember as I was reading this book, I thought about particularly when I was a child and money would be collected in church for the poor. And I always wondered, I looked around and I didn't see anyone. And I wondered where they were and why we never saw them in our church. We seemed to care about them, but they weren't sort of considered part of that community.
Exactly. And there are these invisible barriers that, because of the value proposition, prohibit people from actually coming in. I believe that you can go into almost any neighborhood in Dallas, in any sector, and you'll be hard-pressed to find a faith community that is organized in such a way that low-income people, the quote-unquote poor, can function in those communities as peers and partners. They're always projects or problems, but not peers and partners, and that's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. You open the book with a stark fact, which is that the AP reported last year that by the end of 2012, the poverty rate in this country would be about what it was back when LBJ launched the Great Society.
Right. We've lost ground. And there have been many factors that have contributed to that: offshoring, the decline of organized labor, the decline of manufacturing, although that's coming back in some ways now, the failure of public education to equip a workforce for the jobs that are available, that are crying for employees, number of factors. But the bottom line is we've slid backwards because we've not been attentive to investing in the population that suffers most because of poverty.
What do you think puts certain people, certain communities at a greater risk for poverty than others?
Well, again, the things I just mentioned, but also the environment, the expectation. And again, the value we assign to people is often self-fulfilling. I tell people all the time, most of us who listen to this radio program or who work in my world or who are professional people, we have financial advisors at the top, right? I believe we need a whole army of financial advisors at the bottom to create a new floor under which no one would fall. And as we make that kind of community investment, the return on that investment will be enormous in terms of better educated students, a better qualified workforce, more creativity and invention, safer neighborhoods, neighborhoods where people have the leisure to be more involved in things that middle class and more affluent people take for granted. The interesting thing is that number of troubled families is rising. If you talk about asset poverty, you get a number over 40% of the people in Dallas are really asset poor. And by that, we mean that they're just on the brink of a crisis if one thing goes wrong. And so this is a very difficult problem, has many factors contributing to its creation. But I think one of the solutions is to begin to regard everyone as assets and not as liabilities.
So your story is interesting. You were serving in a relatively affluent community outside Dallas and sort of began serving the poor, and I'll use that in air quotes, and then recognized you wanted to engage more deeply. I would imagine that people in your church didn't say, well, we don't want those people coming in the doors. We don't want them worshiping with us on Sundays. So what do you think creates those subtle divisions that would keep someone from walking in the door of an establishment that seems to be for middle-class people or upper-middle-class people?
It is the perception of value. It is the perception of respect. It is. It has to do with where do I belong, right? So in my church in Richardson, where I served for 14 years, we had a large ministry to the community of the poor. We had a system whereby we could get food to people. We had a very robust rental assistance program. We had a utility assistance program. We had counselors present who would help people kind of put their lives back together. We could never get, quote unquote, those people, those wonderful people who came to us for help in an emergency. We could never get them to come to church. And we surmised it was because of our clothing, our sanctuary, our cars, and our houses. I don't think that was it at all now in retrospect. I think because we didn't invite those people into the solution in a very organic, even leadership way, and we didn't convey to them value, that's why they didn't come back. They came to us for the needs they had. They didn't feel like there was anything they could contribute to us, and therefore they didn't come back.
Yeah.
Had we invited them in to run the program, they would have come back to our church. I know they would have. I've experienced that since coming to City Square almost 20 years ago.
Well, let's talk about the approach at City Square, because you are not shy, and other people who are in the program are not shy about turning to someone who has just received assistance in some way and saying, hey, I need you to do this for me. And you have a great story in the beginning of the book about a woman that translated for you.
Right.
On the one hand, people would say, well, why are you asking anything more of this poor woman? She's got a lot going on. What changes when you turn to somebody and say, now you can help me?
Yeah. Well, I didn't have enough sense to really ask her or to see what was there. She wanted to make a contribution once I, in my desperation, invited her in. Something changes when a relationship is based on total reciprocity. When everyone has something to contribute and everyone has something to receive, you change the dynamic. There's no sense of who's rich and who's poor. The day that Josefina Ortiz translated or actually conducted the interview for me because I couldn't speak Spanish, she had all the wealth. She had all the power. I had nothing. I was just an observer, thankful for her. She gave me a great gift, and she gave a great gift to those three women and their families. She had the wealth, and she was honored for having the wealth. It was her contribution. Low-income people, just like all people typically, want to give. That's instinctive into the human condition, and they're just not invited into that process, and they're surprised when they are. We've had story after story after story after story of people being so thrilled that they could contribute, and yet in the beginning so surprised that we would ask.
You know, what's interesting is I think if you or I thought about needing help from people, we would feel the same way. We would be so happy if then we could turn around and do a favor for someone who had just helped us out.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not exactly like payback, but it is, let me do my part. I want to. It's about respect. It's about dignity. It's about the recognition, again, of the creativity and the talent inherent in everybody. The resting capacity of communities is an enormous, it's like a sleeping giant. And if we could just engage people at the bottom economically to contribute their talents, their visions, and their understandings to the problems we're trying to address, we'd be better off. Because the people closest to the problem know most about it. We just seldom consult them.
I know that equitable housing is a great passion of yours. And talk about, clearly there's an availability problem of multi-income housing that's in dense urban areas. But is there something else that keeps people from considering living in a neighborhood where the people on both sides of them are not approximately equal to them? Financially, I should say.
Yeah, I guess it kind of depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about low-income residents, there's so few opportunities for them to be in mixed neighborhoods in Dallas proper. If you're talking about upper-income people moving into neighborhoods like that, one of the obstacles there is our considerations outside the housing itself, and frankly, considerations outside public safety, because our neighborhoods are, you know, relatively safe in Dallas. We're grateful for that. And violence is almost like everywhere, potentially. So it's wrong place, wrong time kind of thing. But public schools mm-hmm. become a big factor in where parents are going to live. I know a lot of people who they tell me, I mean, hundreds of people have told me over the years, I really wish I could live in Dallas like you do, but I can't figure out the school deal. And then we see some people after school's over coming back. That's unfortunate because the contribution of these families to the public schools could be enormous. So there are factors like that that really don't relate to poverty. There's also the public will, the whole issue of what do we will to be in Dallas? I know when Tom Leppert was the mayor, I worked on a task force, and he told us, he said, I don't want a 500-page report to put on a shelf. I want a plan going forward for the development of affordable housing, including permanent supportive housing for formerly homeless people, and I want it on the back of a napkin. He said, I want you guys to figure out how to do this. And we were moving toward a really fundamental shift in Dallas, I think, in terms of a housing trust fund that would have been funded by a bond proposal. And it would have been 20 times the size of the state's housing trust fund. And then 2008 October hits, and everything goes on fast pause, and we're hoping to bring that back in the next couple of years. But Dallas needs more money, pre-development, conceptual dollars, study dollars, and development dollars for good housing partners to go into neighborhoods that are underpopulated with lots of infill opportunities to develop affordable housing for families, and we can solve the homeless problem in Dallas by providing permanent supportive housing units. And we've made some progress over the past several years thanks to partners like Mary Ann Russ at the Dallas Housing Authority, and thanks to the work of the Bridge and the city itself, and then to, you know, nonprofit providers like our Community Development Corporation. We've made some progress on housing people who are homeless.
So partnerships are sort of the key in the 21st century, and you talk a lot about that in the book. And it sounds great to take private entities and faith-based organizations and public dollars and put them all together. It would happen much more often if it weren't so complicated.
Right.
So can you talk about what makes it complicated?
Well, there are several things that make it complicated. First of all, I think it takes a long time to develop trust. Each entity in a partnership has its own body of work. And so there's the time factor. And then, so who are you going to trust enough to really get into a collaboration that becomes a partnership? You know, a collaboration is where everybody comes to lunch once a month and then goes home until the next meeting, doesn't really think about it until they come back and have their sack lunch. A partnership means people leave stuff on the table and skin in the game. And so when you get to that point, you've got to really have trust, you've got to have time, you've got to see, again, the return on the investment of all that. And when those things begin to align, there's really power in that. I know we've been in a medical partnership with the Baylor Healthcare System since 1997, and we've treated thousands of people in a very high-care, high-touch manner, and we're very grateful to Baylor. That partnership was forged and has been forged over more than a decade now. And so it takes time, commitment, hard work. But we are looking constantly for new partners. And I can tell you stories now about some partnerships we're working on that are not advanced enough really to unveil, but partnership's the key to everything.
My guest is Larry James. He's president and CEO of City Square and author of the new book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Larry James, who is president and CEO of City Square and author of the new book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. You can also find Larry's blog online, larryjamesurbandaily.blogspot.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Larry, why is this word neighbor so important to you? Why do you not say client or recipient, or why does neighbor really fit the bill?
Again, neighbor for us is a conveyance of value and of standing. I think it's a mistake to professionalize poverty. Mm-hmm. I think it dehumanizes people. We probably violate traditional social work boundaries at times because of our engagement with people, but we consider that we are neighbors, that we're all neighbors, and so we're all on a level playing field, and we're just at different places at different times with different opportunities and assets. And so we don't use the word client because it depersonalizes the individual who's in front of us. Hmm. We regard everyone as if they are our neighbor, and we hope to be a good neighbor to them.
A neighbor also feels much more permanent.
Yes.
In a way that is fundamentally empowering.
Absolutely. And it's the basis for all community. Our goal is human and community development. And so we accord respect to every human being who comes across our pathway, and we make the assumption that they are, in fact, our neighbors. And so we try to relate to them like, the folks next door, hmm, where I go home at night.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Sharon in Southlake. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Sharon.
I'm a longtime admirer of City Square and all that Larry and his staff accomplished there with their neighbors. And I was just, one observation I have from personal experience is that folks who suffer from long-term mental illness can also benefit from having that mutual regard and seeing them as having something to contribute. That's one observation. And then a question I had was, has the City Square model, does it have any twins or replicated institutions around the state or around the country?
Thanks for your call.
And I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks, Sharon.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more about the mental health issues. I think you're exactly right. As a matter of fact, there is incredible therapeutic benefit for everyone involved when we regard each other as neighbors and when we see the value that's in every person. My dad used to tell me there are no throwaway people, and I think that's a sound and wise counsel. Regarding replicability, yeah, I think there are. I think there are organizations across the country and around the country that have found some of these same principles to be very workable. We actually have an organization that we founded in San Antonio. It's called Urban Connection San Antonio. It's been at work on the near west side of San Antonio in a public housing developments for the last 10 years. And there's a great story there. You could Google it and find out about Urban Connection San Antonio. There's an organization called Christian Community Development Association, and it's an organization that represents a lot of organizations like ours that value the contributions of everyone, including low-income folks. Scott Morris, the Church Health Center in Memphis, is another example of a very creative, dynamic model that values the contributions of all the people involved, both the materially wealthy and the materially not so wealthy. So I think across the country there's a movement. I would even mention Sojourners, which is an advocacy organization led by Jim Wallace. But one of the things that Sojourners advocates for is the dignity of everyone and the contributions that all can make and that all should be invited into the process.
Talk about this. There are other faith-based organizations that do very good work that have a vested interest in helping people break their addictions to drugs and alcohol and other substances. But they say, we'll help you get off these substances, but unless you're kind of actively participating, we can't help you. That doesn't seem to be the approach that you take.
No. Again, we apply the golden rule. We attempt to treat others the way we would like to be treated if we found ourselves in their shoes. So, for example, in housing, we're doing everything we can to move toward, we're not there yet, but we're moving toward a housing first model, which basically says you need housing to get over what's troubling you, to get through where you are. Mm-hmm. And we recognize that. You can't rebuild your life if you're on the street. It's very difficult. You have poster child examples of successes, but in terms of long-term scalable success, if I don't have a place to live, I really have no platform for progress. And so we tell people, be a good neighbor. If your issues are creating difficulties for you, we're just outside your door. Please engage us. Just don't bring your issues into the common spaces where you affect other neighbors negatively. Talk to us. We're there for you to achieve your life goals. Don't bring your problems, if you have them, into the common areas. And if you abide by that, and if you're a good neighbor, you'll be able to stay as long as you need to get your life together. The same thing is true in food distribution and health and in employment training, all the things we do. We give people a chance in spite of their failure, because, you know, Chris, I mess up all the time.
You and me both.
But I have the great privilege of having a strong family, mm-hmm. Having lots of friends, of having a spiritual connection and network, of having professional buds who really, you know, swat me in the rear end when I need to be. And so when I fail, the impact of my failure is minimized by all this network of community I have. We're trying to create that same kind of network of community around every neighbor we know, so that when failure comes, it's not fatal, but it's just a temporary setback.
What have you learned about communicating the existence of that network of support to people who have had it for so long that it feels invisible, that it feels as if they are sort of where they are by simply maybe the grace of God, but also by just their own initiative?
Yeah, their own hard work and pulling it up with the bootstraps. It's like Ann Lott told me one time. She said, Larry, she said, you know, people say that our folks should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. The only problem is it's hard to do when you don't have any boots, right?
Right.
Or it's like the guy I heard say to his son, you know, you were born on third base. Don't jump up and start screaming about how good your triple was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have to kind of take an honest inventory of what does my success, quote unquote, mean? How did I get to it? Is hard work involved? Of course. Is good education involved? Of course. But what were the things that set me up for that? What were the motivators that drove me? What were the things that backstopped me that aren't available to everyone? And I think we just have to be serious about our own limitations and about how we, all of us who've achieved success, or any of us who've achieved success, have done so thanks to the efforts and the predecessors and all those who walked alongside of us and all those who are out in front of us that we know are always going to be there for us.
Yeah, it's occurred to me that I don't know that a lot of CEOs put in a harder, longer day than like school cafeteria ladies and, you know, people who are cleaning their offices.
Right.
Same number of hours, maybe even same amount of passion and effort. It just, they're starting from a different place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Lou in Rockwall. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I was calling. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's amazing.
Thanks,
and
Lou.
Most of all, I love your philosophy of wanting to engage people. I live in a fairly affluent area, and I have a local friend, and I also have a relative in another state. And both of these families are, spouses. Neither of them are working, and they've both told me that they're, you know, having difficulties on food stamps and things like that, but I don't really know what I can do to help them. That's my question.
Okay, I hear you, and you know, your question is coming from a deep place in your life, and it has power because of that, because it's authentic. I think whatever you've been doing across the years to support them as friends and family, you need to continue doing that. You need to stay in communication with them. you know, if you have the ability to assist them in some way, either financially or emotionally or by your presence, I would recommend you consider that. If they have specific questions about public benefits, I'd love to hear from you. I'd be glad to try to hook you up with those resources wherever they are. We're fortunate in that everywhere in this country there are resources available. I would argue they're not available enough. They're not large enough, the quantities, but there are ways to help, and I would be glad to hear from you. Again, I'm ljames@citysquare.org, and we'd be glad to try to see what we could do if you wanted us to do that.
We have an email here from Wayne who asks if or when the book will be available on audio. Wayne says, my wife and I are familiar with your work over a span of years, and we'd love to have a copy accessible to a blind reader.
Yes. I know Wayne and Sandy very well. They're dear friends. They were members of my church when I was in Richardson. We're working on that. Wayne, thanks for asking, and thanks for putting me on record that we're really working on it. It's all about funding and getting that done, but it is available on some of the ebook services like Kindle, but we're still working on the audio part.
So the ebook that it can be read aloud, but it sort of sounds like a computer at this point. Is that?
Yeah,
is that
I'm not even certain, Chris, about mm-hmm. the technology. I'm not sure what's available.
All right, so maybe out in the future we'll be able to have
right.
that. Can you talk a little bit about this, the roles that race and ethnicity play in our sort of struggles to see each other strictly as neighbors?
Yeah. Racism is still a problem, and it has to do with how power is transmitted and utilized, how decisions are made. And then it also, as your question implies, it begins to shape how we respond to different people, and the whole stereotypical way of thinking about people, the categorizing. We live in a very complex world with all the information just coming at us at every turn, and so we begin to take shortcuts. It's a very dangerous thing to do when it comes to people, because people are worth more than any shortcut. And then I think there's still unspoken, sometimes verbalized, hateful, racist attitudes about people, and assigning grades to people relative to their success or failure based on race. I think we see some of that in our current immigration debate. I think we continue to see it as we think about the struggle of Black folks and in public education. We have ways to go, and I would counsel that our faith and our spirituality and our national traditions, our heritage and the promise of our nation, call forth from us better than we often are able to give for whatever reason. One of the things we do at City Square is we work hard on community that transcends all those categories. And again, when you look at the concept of wealth, you begin to see that there's such beauty and wealth and texture and depth in the variety of folk we have in this city. And I don't want to cheat myself by ever cutting myself off from someone because of any kind of category, like skin color or ethnicity or heritage or whatever. I want to be in the middle of all that I can be, because that's where the real joy and beauty in life is found. And so racism works against all of us, and it oppresses a good segment of the population.
How often do you meet people who say, well, I'd be open to creating friendships with people who are struggling financially or struggling socially, but I don't know anyone like
right.
that.
Right. That's a real challenge. And you know, a place like ours does not always afford people the kind of volunteer opportunities they really need to get engaged at that level, because we've got so many folks who are our neighbors close to us who are coming to us to solve problems that are volunteering. Oftentimes there's not enough volunteer positions for all the people who want to come down and see what we're doing. Having said that, we also work with people who want to come and engage people in conversations, and we actually set up situations where they actually can do some of that. I think you've got to find a way You got to be creative to find a way on your own. I try to put myself in positions where I know I'm going to meet people who are financially in a different place than I am. Sometimes it seems artificial, especially at the start, but it doesn't have to be that way. I go to the corner of Dawson and Malcolm X every Thursday at 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. If I'm in town, I'm there. And typically I'll take an ice chest full of bottled water, and I sit down on the porch of an abandoned house right next door to Billy Marandino's service station. And I just sit there. And people coming from the I-45 bridges to the Austin Street Center, the shelter, come through there. And I offer bottled water when it's hot and coffee when it's cold. And I have no agenda. And I just meet some of the most phenomenal people. And now I've been doing this for over a year. You know, we're looking for each other. They know mm-hmm. me by name. I know most of the people on the street by name. And we just have conversations about life. And in that context, the conversation always gets down to, do you know where I can find a job? Hmm. Here's how long I've been out here. I can't find a job. And I can't get a job out here. Or I just have to get, I've got to figure out a way to get me an apartment again. I can't. Or how am I going to scrape together the money I need to get into the Salvation Army's program? Or, and they're doing wonderful work. It's a very meager kind of fee, but people have nothing. And that begins to shape how I look at the world, you know,
yeah.
because I'm with these people who have a totally different kind of perspective. I told a church group last week, you know, I've got my corner, and that's where I learn about life on the corner and about reality. I think everybody needs to find a corner. Maybe not a corner like I'm talking about, but you need to find a place where you just know socioeconomically and culturally maybe you're different. And you're going to go there not to say anything or to impart some grand wisdom, but to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go there because I give anything of much value. I just go there because I receive so much. I learn so much. I begin to understand more.
Larry James is with us. He's president and CEO of City Square and author of the new book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Larry James, who is president and CEO of City Square and author of the new book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Going back to what you were telling us before about the corner that you go to once a week, you have written in this book and said elsewhere that you need poor people, financially poor people, more than they need you or anything you can do for them. Will you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, people don't need me. I mean, we all need each other. Mm-hmm. That's the basis of community. But people don't really need Larry James. What people really need and want is a fair shot and opportunity. So given that reality, I need to be connected to other people who have a different perspective, who have a different experience, who have a life story. I mean, there's something incredibly nourishing about consuming the life stories of other people. I mean, I think that's the power of narrative and the power of perspective that comes from, again, the diversity of kinds of friendships. I'm pretty bored with people like me. So I think there's just something that is invigorating, challenging, instructive about knowing people who aren't quote-unquote like me, given the fact that basically, fundamentally, we're all the same. We all want opportunity and fairness. We all want to make our own way about things that allow us to provide for families and that sort of thing. But we also can gain so much from being connected to one another in a very serious way.
How does this work correspond for you to the work you did early in your career, which was essentially preaching the gospel?
Right. Well, it's interesting. I never intended to be a minister. I followed my wife off to a Church of Christ college in Arkansas, and while I was there, I got a call to ministry. And after graduation, we moved to Memphis. This was about 3.5 years after Dr. King was assassinated, and Memphis was still in a turmoil. And then we moved, after a year there, we moved to Shreveport, Louisiana, where we lived for 2 years and 45 minutes. My tenure there wasn't too helpful, actually. But my church was on a boundary between a very poor neighborhood and a very rich neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly racist time, and the church was racist. And, you know, I was a young pastor. It was my first full-time church, and I had all these African-American folks coming to church. I'd just go out and invite everybody to come to church, and they would come. Mm-hmm. And that didn't set too well with some of the old folks. That's a whole other story. Then we moved to New Orleans, where I finished my seminary degree and where I worked on a PhD in American history at Tulane. And I had a church right downtown. And I actually had two churches. I had the Sunday crowd, which was basically transplants from Tennessee and Texas. And then I had the Monday to Saturday church, which was the pimps and the fortune tellers and the prostitutes and the schizophrenics and the very poor folks who lived on the street. So I had these two congregations that really shaped my view of how I read the Bible, frankly. And then I moved back home to Richardson for 14 years, and we got involved in all kinds of social ministry, including HIV/AIDS. And that was a dramatically formative time for me. And then it was from there that I came downtown. And all during this, I didn't really realize it at the time, but in retrospect, I realized that my personal theology was becoming very reductionist, and it was becoming simpler and simpler. And I remember telling the church toward the end of my tenure, I'm really believing more and more and less. Hmm. And then, in fact, my life and my ministry is about following what I can read and learn and understand of this person, Jesus, into the marginalized places of life, because that's where I think he is found. I'm not taking him there. I'm going there to discover his presence, and I find it everywhere. And so it's my own personal spiritual journey. It's just kind of where I am, and that's how my own understanding has developed and really become much more simple.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Thomas in Garland. Hey, Thomas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question or slash comment had to do with debt. And, you know, the title of your book is about the wealth of our neighbors. And as an attorney, I deal with debt relief. And a lot of my clients struggle with sort of the spiritual aspects of debt. And I wondered how your organization, or if you have any, you know, personal thoughts on debt and spirituality.
It's a great question. I have a lot of thoughts about how debt happens. As a matter of fact, our public policy area, our division, is led by Reverend Gerald Britt, and we have been very active in the last year and in this legislative session in getting really tighter controls over payday lenders in the state. And the verdict is still out for this legislature. As a matter of fact, there's a hearing today, may have already occurred, but we're very conscious of the spiritual side of indebtedness and what it does to families. For one thing, very, very low-income families who have to use this kind of financial service, if you will, find themselves on a treadmill they can't get off of. Because to service such a high interest, high service fee debt, sometimes up to 600%, if you calculate it honestly, there's no way to service that and get out of it if you're very, very poor. That then begins to impinge upon a person's psyche, which is what I think I hear you talking about. And you can go up the food chain much higher as well into the middle class, where the level of debt is really amazing. And I know you, if you work in this area, know more about that than I do. So I would say to you, yeah, I think there's a liberation that comes from being debt-free. And I'm working very near the bottom of the economy, where debt is easy to incur and very difficult to get out of. And I do see the oppressive nature of that kind of financial arrangement on families.
For people who don't know, payday lenders, essentially you go and get a very small loan, sometimes as little as $50 or $100 or $200, and then you have to pay it back within a couple of weeks or else the interest rates just jump higher and higher.
Right, that's right.
Do you think this should be outlawed altogether?
I think there needs to be financial vehicles for low-income people, but I think it needs to be a straightforward financial transaction like at any bank, mm-hmm. with a cap on the percentage rate that's charged and regulations on all the fees. And that's what we're driving for right now in this legislative session.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jan on the line in Irving. Hi, Jan.
Hello, Chris. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yes, and I have met Mr. James when I was working in the community development field and since then. And what I'd like to hear him say something about is the value of working, helping the poor while you're also redeveloping and bringing about community renewal. In other words, interesting the real estate redevelopment people, the city planners, the chamber of commerce people, the churches, and bringing that all together and how you make it work, particularly say something about your tall office building where you have had formerly homeless people on the bottom and then the penthouses on top. How did you get that going and how's it working?
Well, thank you, Jan. You kind of answered the question with your litany of partners in that how do you do it list. So you really covered all the bases. City Walk at Accord at 511 North Accord is a 15-story high-rise that had been abandoned for 20 years when we purchased it in 2006. It's a project of the Central Dallas Community Development Corporation, which is basically our housing arm. And we did pull together all those players. We used three different kinds of tax credit vehicles. We raised quite a bit of philanthropic dollars, and the city put in over $2 million into the project. And in essence, it's three buildings in one. So basement through three is office commercial. 4 through 14, 200 apartments that are all affordable. 100 of those 200 set aside for the homeless, and 100 set aside for working people up to $29,000 a year. If you make more than that, you can't live there. And then the third part of the building is the condos you mentioned that are selling at market rates. We've sold two of the six. I call it our neighborhood in vertical, and it really is a mixed-use, mixed-income development, the first affordable housing development in downtown Dallas in living memory. But it involved all those people you mentioned, and we're continuing to work on housing. We're about to build 50 more houses right across the street from our big new project at Malcolm X and I-30, the Opportunity Center. And these 50 homes will be in a gated community, and they will house 50 of the most expensive homeless persons to Dallas County. The 250 most expensive persons to Dallas County average $40,000 a year just in county costs at the jail and at Parkland and through Medicaid mental health services. We can provide housing and care for the folks for way less than $15,000 a year. So that also involves all those partners you mentioned, and we're doing this in a consortium that was convened by the W.W. Kruth Jr. Foundation. So you're right on target. You're in our sweet spot of what we like to do as we address these issues.
Gated community, why?
It's going to be a gated, secure community. It's going to provide security for the residents, and it's going to block just people walking in and taking advantage of people who would be inclined to open their homes to others who maybe shouldn't be there or who haven't qualified to be there or whatever. It's just a matter of public safety.
Can you talk about the culture of North Texas as pertains to its openness to engaging with neighbors of different socioeconomic levels as compared with other cities in the United States?
That's a great question. I think we probably when we talk about this notion, everyone seems to like it once they kind of get their minds around it. I really don't know that I have a way to compare to other cities. I know in San Antonio the concept has worked well. I think we are, you know, probably about average in terms of receiving new ideas. A lot of people have taken this notion and have been highly motivated to be involved with us because they like the idea of everybody playing a part, everybody having a role, everyone making their contribution. And they also like the idea of us listening to people close to the ground. There are a lot of principles here that are just basic community organizing principles. And so in cities like Chicago and New York, San Francisco, even San Diego, we found organizations that are working hard in the same way.
What do you say to people who say, look, you're doing great work. We see this with your organization and others. Let's get the government completely out of the business of supporting people who are in trouble and let good-hearted individuals make the choice to take action.
The scale is too large. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. I mean, I think I heard one time that if you liquidated the assets of every church in North America, you couldn't pay the HUD budget for 1 year. The scale is enormous. And what people don't recognize is organizations like City Square are actually doing that work in contracts with the government. So we've got close to $15 million budget this year. We've got 140 people on our payroll working for us. This summer we'll have 300 AmeriCorps members scattered all over the city and state working on various issues. We contract with city, county, state, and feds to get this work done. So we are actually we're doing the work the government is paying for. It's not like there's a mythical government office out there somewhere that's doing all the work. There are some of those offices that do different sorts of things, but a lot of the work is done by local organizations like ours who are in contract with public entities.
Summertime is coming up. You have some stories in here about teenagers coming in to sort of engage with your community, and you've discovered things that work really well and things that don't work really
right.
Well.
You know, in the early days, we always had kids camps, and we would staff those by having church groups come in and do those camps a week at a time. And we really did that in two locations for a number of years. That's how we got into the Roseland Homes housing development years ago, 1996. What we found was those youth groups that were coming in doing phenomenal service were crowding our kids out. And so we changed it. We offered what was called at that time the urban experience. And so youth groups who were looking for a summer mission would come to our place, and we would just basically immerse them in an urban experience. It was educational. It had a service component, but they were not running the kids' camp. With the tuition we charged those wealthier kids, we hired our kids for summer jobs, and they provided the youth camp experience. Worked out really well. It was a hard sell, though, to outside youth groups because I think, you know, it was hard for them to admit they had anything to learn really about urban life. They wanted to come and serve poor children, play with poor kids, hold poor kids, and, you know, just have this great experience. But when we shifted it to, let us tell you something about this, there's something to learn here, and in the meantime, provide jobs for kids from the neighborhoods, it was just harder to sell.
Larry James is president and CEO of City Square and author of the new book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. Larry, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. We had Jeff Whittington on the phone. He's also executive producer. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. You can get that podcast free online at kera.org/think. And, of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.